Hello and welcome to Dateline New Haven. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make New Haven tick. For more than a decade, a dynamic duo by the names of Mary Lou Olesky and Peter Webster have been making New Haven tick in both ways, both visible and behind the scenes. And you would never know they were married. It took me about 10 years to figure that out. Mary Lou ran the International Festival of Arts and Ideas for the last 11 years. Her husband, Peter, has been a tireless community activist fighting crime, organizing neighbors, and crusading for change in the Wooster Square neighborhood and the city at large. Now they're moving on to greener northern pastures as Mary Lou begins a job as the new director of the Hopkins Center at Dartmouth College. But first, we're not going to let them go. We're going to get their takes on the city that have helped move forward. And thanks also to Yale New Haven Hospital for providing support for today's program. Welcome to the studio, folks. I'm so glad you guys came in and I get to say one long goodbye.
It's great and deeply moving to be here.
Well, it's funny. In New Haven, we're used to people coming in every 2 or 4 years and shuttling out and having all sorts of energy and reviving the place and giving us new ideas. And I always thought that was a strength, not a weakness of the city. You know, if some of us are lifers, but the rest of us really benefit from all the great talent that comes through this place. But you guys stuck around. You guys didn't just pass through. Was that the plan?
I think if once you've engaged New Haven, you become a lifer, even if you move away, because it's not the kind of city that you can rip out of your heart. It becomes part of you. And I might be moving away. It's not like Hotel California. You can check out, but you can never leave. I don't plan on checking out soon, but it's a city that's part of my DNA and of my soul, so I can't say that I'm moving away. I'm just going up the road.
You just put it so well, because I've always sounded like an idiot for the last almost 40 years, and people say, why do you love New Haven? Because I'm either defining it as what it's not, or I'm just completely vague. I'll say either we're halfway between Boston, New York, which I never go to because there's so much to do here. And it's exciting, like those places, and it's diverse, but it's on a scale that you can make a difference and be involved and enjoy it, not get overwhelmed by the hassles of just getting from point A to point B, as long as you use the bus every day. But that's what we're not, And then I feel like it's such an interesting place. I remember one person who spent a bunch of years here said it's spicy people.
Yeah.
John DeStefano says it's social capital. Sticky, right? But he uses the word sticky. Those are vague words. It's just a great place. You love to be part of it. It's got all sorts of stuff, great, interesting stuff going on. It's challenges working together where everyone's trying to save the world and kind of stumbling and then moving forward and being together. And we even fighting, we kind of like fight together, but it's us against the world. And there's this, I don't know, what do you think, Mary Lou? Any thoughts on that? Are you a sticky advocate? Or?
I think I've spent most of my time here trying to get New Haven to not think of itself or not define itself by what it's not, but what
right.
it is.
I agree with you.
That's
so much.
That's been my job. And I think the festival has helped to remind New Haven that it lives on a global platform that's relevant and vital and exciting. And I think one of the reasons that we've stuck around so long is that we've learned as much about ourselves and gained as much as people as we've given back to the city. So
I think that's called love.
Yeah, it is called love. It is called love. And, you're not used to that reciprocal when you move to a place and you're there to serve and you do a job and then you go home. And that's been sort of our lives, right? We lived in Houston, we lived in California, we lived in New York. But in New Haven, we learned how to really be citizens.
And neighbors.
And neighbors. And part of a community. And that's what's called home.
That's interesting. That's so cool. And the other thing I like about New Haven is that it's a place where you can really be yourself.
Yeah.
Like, I'm kind of an oddball. I never fit in like corporate settings, or I went to Yale, but I was such an outsider. Everywhere I'm an outsider, but you can be an outsider and be yourself. Like, I became a religious Jew, and like, that's cool here.
Yeah.
And everybody was like, embrace you for it. I got closer to people, like, do other things because they like who you are. And as a journalist, I did different kind of journalism and found places to do it. And, I love kind of quirky art stuff. I love quirky art stuff. Since I was, even before this whole explosion of New Haven's Renaissance, last bunch of years, even when I was here in what they call the glum 70s, I loved it immediately because of all the alternative culture here and underground culture and great ideas. But let's talk about that. So did you go, the Arts and Ideas Festival is happening right now.
Yes,
the first
it is.
Time in 12 years you have not been running it.
Yes.
Have you been to any of the events?
Oh, yeah. I'm so happy to be a civilian at the festival and watch it flourish. We have such a great team there. So the co-executive directors, Chad Herzog and Liz Fisher and Tom Griggs, are doing a great job carrying it forward. And it's just great to watch the things we've talked about come to fruition.
It's hard to give up a baby.
It is hard to give up a baby. But you know what? Just like every proud parent at a graduation, you watch something move on with elegance and might, and you go, yay, team, we did it.
So what was the favorite thing you went to this year so far?
Well, I have to say...
All of them.
No, I have to... yes, all of them. But
that's a cop-out. Tell me your favorite moment.
Belonging was so moving
and that was
for
the,
me.
And you nurtured, you saw that Aaron Jafaris was this very talented, homegrown playwright and lyricist, and works a lot with community people, go across barriers, which is that favorite part of New Haven, people from different walks of life who do work together. So he created this play this year. I guess it's a hip-hop or a...
It's kind of a hip-hop theater forum oratorio. It's a new form, I think, actually.
And as he always does, he brought in people from the community whose lives are being sung about who are amateurs, who they're training, and he brought in professionals and that kind of stuff. Yeah. Peter, talk about that.
So actually, I have to say something about that, not to interrupt you, but now you're going to see the dynamic of our relationship. But, you know, the thing that made Belonging great was that Aaron was collaborating with someone who really is not like himself, an Asian American composer who cared deeply about social justice, based in Seattle. And Byron Aoyoung, because the piece is local, we talk a lot about Aaron, and his contribution is amazing, but it put it on a national level. It wasn't just about the local kid done good and gone back to the neighborhood and enriched the neighborhood. This is about an international piece. You know, it premiered at Virginia Tech. It's going to go around the country.
Was this the same pair who did the Stuck Elevator?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, now you made that happen as the A&I person, Arts and Ideas. So I saw Stuck Elevator. I haven't seen Belonging. Stuck Elevator was a great play about, you know, Chinese American delivery people stuck in elevator, class differences. And so I think what you're saying, Mary Lou, is you have someone's from New Haven through the International Festival of Arts and Ideas, which is one of the great institutions now in New Haven. I watched this from the beginning, since the 90s when they started, and how they try to bring outside people with new ideas and talents working alongside, either on the same set of events or sometimes in the same events, like in this case, with someone local who's talented, mm-hmm. bringing a lot of people and coming up with a new idea that's very New Haven and looks more broadly.
Exactly, exactly. And the other piece of this is that after 22 years, this festival has become so authentically engaged with the community that, you know, we were sitting there watching kids that our daughter went to school with on stage and just lighting up the stage.
I wanted to say
that. Sharing their hearts.
All right, so Peter, what were you going to say?
Shut up.
No, you don't have to shut up.
Yeah. No, but this Belonging was a perfect example of something that was so local. As Mary Lou said, my daughter knew and went to school with most of the young people that sang this. And it just shows you the profound impact that art has on lives and how people that are infinitely local are able to reach out to the world. Because they use the phrase, gun waving New Haven, which I've heard from...
I like that phrase.
Well, it's not a great phrase to
have.
It's not a fair...
I don't think it's necessarily a fair picture of our city, but it sounds really good.
Well, it's a piece about gun violence.
And it's true about some people's lives.
It's a piece about gun violence, and it moves from hip-hop to the most achingly lyrical musical selections, and it's flawless. Stephanie Tubiolo, who is the choral director of this piece... is a genius, and she's a person from here too.
So this is a musical piece about gun violence, mm-hmm. and you said it started at Virginia Tech, and then it's here, which I love that idea.
Yeah,
because when we think about guns, we either stereotype urban settings and people of color, or it's these white settings like Virginia State where you have these kind of wacko mass shooters.
Right,
and does this piece bridge those two realities
that's
and
the
find
intent
a common
of the piece.
That's the intent.
And that's one
Takes
of the reasons
why
we... Takes
some of us a few times to get the obvious.
Yes. that's the intent of the piece, and that's one of the reasons why we were happy that Jimmy Green was courageous enough to spend Father's Day on
and
the
New Haven
Green.
And that's the saxophonist whose daughter at 6 years old was killed in the Newtown Massacre.
Right.
And he dedicated two albums to her memory.
Exactly.
And he performed Sunday night as a headliner.
Right.
I'm a dad. I have a daughter, and I can't imagine the strength of purpose and the infinite love that he has for that child. For him to get up in public and share his agony and share his hope for the future. And the fact that we can tolerate violence amongst ourselves on any level, and with guns as the main way of doing it, it's intolerable that this kind of violence continues to exist.
And I know that you've had a lot of concern with that, Peter. I saw the art piece you did, Installation Art Space, based on gun violence with New Haven police. You know, this is another example, Jimmy Green. See, you have a national musician in a local setting tying into what they do. You know, I was listening to some of that music, and I was thinking how it doesn't have words, but it's inspired by what happened to his daughter. And sometimes the way we mark tragedy is to stand up and insist on moving on by saying we're going to keep living even though our lives have changed.
We must.
And we create something new. I was thinking in Judaism, that's called saying Kaddish for 11 months after we lose someone in death. You say a prayer every day for 11 months, three times a day at the prayer service, and it needs to be done in the presence of nine others, so you're out in community. And the interesting thing about that prayer, and it's persisted for more than 1,000 years, and I think here's why. It's an insight like that with the piece, Jimmy Green, that had no words about Newtown, but it was about Newtown. That prayer doesn't mention death. It's about proclaiming faith in God, because you don't really believe in God when someone dies. You believe in that, just doesn't fear. It's the moment when life seems the most unjust and it makes the least sense. And the tradition, I think in all faith traditions and cultural art traditions, the traditions persevere that have truth about how we live and how we continue to live. So the idea, and I found there's so much insight in this, is that you have to be coming out of your house after the first 7 days when people come to your house in the presence of other people and stand up and declare at least a possibility, imagining of moving on, but not pretending that your life hasn't changed, because you're remembering it every day and you're thinking about it, incorporating it into daily life as you emerge and return to your rituals, other daily routines, and live your life in other ways, but you still remember that it's been shaped, the person you lost, but that you're going to keep on living. And that's kind of our calling as human beings. And I kind of feel like that's what Jimmy Green was doing.
Absolutely.
That was so beautifully said, Paul. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
And I think actually all of Sunday in New Haven was that kind of prayer, because it engaged community. And yet, if you didn't know the story and you listened to Jimmy's music supported by the New Haven Symphony, you'd know it was great art. And he was nominated for a Grammy, and you were communed with his art and his heart and his family's hearts.
And the act of creating it, whatever, however it's interpreted by other people, is the tribute.
Absolutely.
Right.
And it
Absolutely.
Keeps, and it's something about keeping his daughter's memory.
Right. Mm-hmm. And art is generous, because I believe that when a note of music goes out, if there's a great word, if there's anything like that, it will, what's being memorialized will live on until the last memory of the last person who remembered that dies. And things that move us deeply, we tend to share with other people. And so even if it's like 10 times removed, that memory will continue to live in the person decades away. So what Jimmy Green is doing is, yes, he's praising life. He's praising his daughter and embracing humanity, which something I find that New Haven kind of does every day. I've been in every neighborhood in the city, and I am stunned by how people get through the day and love through the day. And I just wish that the city could embrace itself even more and realize that it is a cohesive, rich, brawling, difficult town, but just one that you just have to love every day.
And we're embracing and saying goodbye to Peter Webster and Mary Lou Oleski, who are here on Dateline New Haven and WNHH Radio, your home for community radio at 103.5 FM and live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. They're leaving New Haven after 11 years. That's nothing to mourn. They're going on to great new opportunities. Instead, we're celebrating all the great work they've done in New Haven and the mark they've left, so that their contributions will be long outlasting, their presence here. Now, Mary Lou, your formal contributions were as director of the Festival International Arts and Ideas. You've been doing it since 2005. What were your original goals when you came here, and how long did you expect to stay, honestly?
Honestly, I didn't think we would be here for longer than 3 years, five at the most. I had hoped that I would be able to add some vigor to the festival. I think that when I arrived, it was doing a great job bringing a lot of people here to do work, but the really vibrant connection to new work and the international world and rooting that in the community was not as strong as I think it is today. So, you know, my goal was basically to try to make it more well-known and put it on the map and have people celebrate it. And, you know, to a great degree, I think we've done that. I mean, you talked earlier about New Haven being a place where you can be kind of quirky, right? And, you know, it's allowed
the festival. You follow your own drummer.
Yeah, you follow your own drummer. It's allowed the festival to do that. It's allowed the festival to commission.
Otherwise, there'd be no point.
Right, exactly. Yeah, right. So, I mean, you know, we've done so much new work. We've done so many new things that are hard to define, and people still embrace it. You know, right now, even this festival, we've got The End of TV, a new world premiere from a company called Manual Cinema. We've got a commission from Martin Bresnik, a local composer. That's a St. John's passion for Harold Bloom as the Christ figure. I mean, who thinks of this, right? And then there's a commission from a Chinese composer later in the week. And that's just this week. But when you think about all the years and all of the work and all the people all around the world that have been here participating in this with us, they don't define New Haven by not. They define New Haven by, I got to do that with those people. It's pretty cool.
We just lost it here, but one of our listeners on Facebook Live was sending out a shout out of love to you guys. Any chance I could read that up against Harry? Sorry about that. We just lost it. Terry W. Chase and three others are sharing it, and Terry says, sure gonna miss you too, !! All capital letters. Thank you for listening and tuning in, Terry. So some of the work you did specifically, you just gave us the big pictures. You expanded how much instrumental music was played.
Mm-hmm.
You expanded how much dance was offered, how much theater, culinary arts, mm-hmm. and multimedia collaborations. Those were very specific goals you had. How did you carry those out?
Yeah, and site-specific work. You know, like a couple of years ago, we did a place called, a piece called, I'm going to forget, the one in the water reserve that was about the land attrition,
mm-hmm.
where we all waltzed in the forest. There's so many works I can't even remember them, but
cry you one,
thank you.
That'll be a dollar.
Okay. But you know, it was a great way to engage our community, and I think we've done what we set out to do. I think the challenges that the festival face are really
Every year there's a freak out if there's going to be money.
Right.
And are there a lot of heavy duty people who believe in supporting New Haven? Every year we think, well, I guess we're no longer worrying if it's going to exist, but we're always thinking, is it going to have to be severely pared down? Because the state always has a fiscal crisis that gets worse every year.
Yeah.
Is that one of the two challenges? Sustainable financing?
Yeah, I think that's an ongoing challenge. I think we've found ways to get around it and raise money to have money into the future. But, you know, state support, government support of the arts is essential. And when you do when you produce an act of love like this for a community, it doesn't come with the kind of ticket price and the kind of revenue that says, oh, we don't need government support. You need it. And
everybody needs to work together.
Everybody needs to work together, and the government needs to do its part. I mean, as we're facing the challenges at the NEA, you know, you see Rosa DeLauro get up on stage the other night and say, you know, art is our soul. Art matters. We need to support it. And we just need to do that. And this festival deserves that.
Okay, I'm going to ask each of you, what are your proudest moment of the 11 years at International Festival de Artes, the single moment you'll never forget of something that happened while you were here?
There was a piece called Circus that was performed that was about lost dreams and surviving and losing a loved one, and it was done in the context of a circus. I think that farce and circus are probably the art forms that are closest to the way life is, and so that was all wound up in that. So that's the one I think I saw it five times.
Well, how about you, Mary Lou? Because you're no longer working this, you're allowed to single one out without dissing anybody else.
Yeah, yeah, no. I you know, you said proudest moment. I think, you
or
know,
the favorite moment.
It would be obvious if I talked about Yo-Yo Ma and the Silk Road Ensemble for Free in the Rain. But the truth be told, I think our first cohort of fellows who graduated from the stage with the mayor, with a proclamation from the city, knowing that they had learned so many lessons from seeing what it took to bring community together around a festival, and that now, 7-8 years into it, the class is now a credit-bearing class at Gateway Community College.
Wow.
You get 4 credits for participating in the curricular piece and the residency in the festival, and to be able to leave this town and know that that will continue just puts a big smile on my face.
Mine too. And the listeners here at WNHH Radio, where you're listening to Dateline New Haven on 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. We're talking about all the great work Mary Lou Alesky and Peter Webster have done in New Haven as they set off for greener northern pastures in Dartmouth. Listener Aaron Good has posted, "Thanks, Peter, for your steady leadership of the Worcester Square Block Watch, your regular attendance at CompStat, and supportive community policing, and capable stewardship of the downtown Worcester Square community management team. A pleasure and a privilege to work with you!" Exclamation point. That's the lead into some stuff I wanted to ask you about. So you lived in Worcester Square, and Peter came here in such an unassuming way. He would just show up everywhere and connect with people of all different walks of life. You know, he was got to love a beat cop named Peter Krause, who was dying slowly from a disease, but continue to go out there and doing community policing with kids in the neighborhood.
We have a tree in his memory in Worcester Square Park.
You planted that tree. You worked on Harvey Koisum's walk, who was another great neighborhood person who died in Russo Park. You promote people you just think are super talents in a way that never, ever put you at the center or sought any credit for you, like Creco, who's this amazing world-class pencil artist in the Hill. He has those great posters you see at Grand Central Station of cities, and he has a museum he started in the Hill that no one ever knows about. And Peter just cared so much about that he called me up and said, "Hey, we're gonna do this event, we're gonna do stuff with kids at the library where they draw their own neighborhood, we get people into," and it is an amazing space there off Ann Street where this like airy, sun-filled, big floor-to-ceiling length portraits and jazz music that Creco himself made that plays in it. But I'm gonna touch on something Aaron Good said. There is some way I think that Peter Webster, in my 37 years of covering New Haven, I have never met anybody who, in the pursuit of promoting civic democracy, is better at running a meeting. And I can't sit through meetings. I hate them unless I'm reporting on them, so I get to like gossip with people on the side. But one meeting I never mind going to, and in fact I love to go to, is the downtown Worcester Square management team meeting. And the management teams were set up with being a community policing in the mid-90s, where they started out as go meet your cop, but it became our engines of grassroots democracy, where people in a neighborhood meet not just with their cops or city officials, and people want to build stuff, test their ideas there. People, the grassroots who want to make change happen, meet together about how to do it and get government accountable. And Peter kept every meeting to an hour, and he packed so much in through advanced work. So I would learn, we would get like 5 stories an hour and have everyone there we could talk to. And the other thing he did that was remarkable is, in a respectful way, he lets everybody talk. But he lets nobody hijack a meeting and prevent other people from talking. It is such a delicate act, and it really speaks to a humble, deep commitment to democracy and respecting all kinds of people and believing in the just tradition of John Stuart Mill, that truth emerges from everyone's voice being heard. Nobody has a monopoly on truth, and that we as a community and as a society solve our problems together. So I wanted to amplify that on Aaron Good. I think he did an amazing job, the management team. And there are other good management teams too, for sure. But I've never seen one that runs better than that. To the clock, 60 minutes, twice as much packed in as anything else you find out. And everyone gets to talk. So just my kudos to that.
Thank you.
That's not a question.
Thank you.
How did you get involved in running a management team?
I don't know. I just sort of happened. Andy Ross was the chair, and he asked me if I would be interested, and so I became vice chair, and Kevin Coughlin was the chair after Andy. And I learned that you can get a lot of stuff done if you're not number one, because you're maneuverable. One of the great things about being a
can you stop? That's a good one. Can you say that again? And that, because I'm sure this isn't just about this committee. You can get a lot of stuff done. What does it mean not to be number one?
Well, if you're number one, you have to wear a suit, even the way you talk to people.
I know, that's one way I immediately related to you.
And the person who is a chair has to be, to maintain a civil environment, focus, and to let everyone participate. But I think that, especially today when civility is at a premium, we need to really listen. We need to listen and be polite. But as a vice chair, as the person who is like the Joe Biden, you get to do a lot of stuff because you're maneuverable. And you get to actually listen to people and talk to people. And I started to find out about the city. I
saw the joy. I watched in your face for years the joy of discovering different people in the city.
What else is there? I mean, if you can't listen and love the people around you, then there's no point in being human. And this is a great city filled with people who have got dreams, people who have needs, and have a lot to offer if you just listen and build together. And I saw a lot of meetings where there was a lot of bitching going on and complaining. And I think that the key is not bitching, but pitch in. You got to pitch in. You got to pitch in. You got to work together. That's all I can say.
And so our listener, Malcolm Shaka Zulu Welfare, writes in, "Hey, Peter!" Exclamation point. "Thank you for your leadership!" Exclamation point. And Kathy Edwards writes in, "New Haven is going to miss you, Mary Lou Oleski and Peter Webster." So Mary Lou Oleski's name is highlighted, and Peter isn't. Peter, do you have a Facebook page?
Yeah.
So maybe Kathy just put a hashtag next to Mary.
Oh, okay.
Maybe they're friends.
I still read newspapers, and the best newspaper I read is probably The Independent, because it has that feeling of, like, I remember sitting down on a Sunday morning and wading through the New York Times with a cup of coffee, and what you have done with The Independent is you have got that attention to detail, that community engagement, and a kind of a thoughtful over arc of what it means to do things. And so it turns my tablet or my phone into a warm, fuzzy piece of excellent newsprint, and I drink my coffee. It's great.
Thank you. So I want to follow up something you said about running a community management team meeting. So there's some great personalities in your neighborhood, as there are in many. And the people who show up care so much about zoning, about voting registration, about the arts, about university and community together, about crime. And some of the people there are very informed, and they do sometimes hijack public meetings in other settings, and not out of bad motives. They care so much and they just can't stop. And once in a while I watch some discussions about, let's say, the proprietors on the green, where one person had a very strong point of view, and I love this guy, and he was being pretty hard on the person. And you made sure he got to have his say. But you also made sure he wasn't mean to the person who came in, that didn't turn into a beat-up session, and that the person who came in also felt like it was worthwhile to participate in this such a subtle way. And there are other people who you made sure they cared so much about the zoning issue on the table, the voting issue on the table, but it's the only setting I've seen them in 10 or 20 years where they didn't go on for more than a few minutes, but they weren't shut up. And I just still can't figure out how you did that, Peter. I don't know how you do that. I'm not good at it.
You know how he does it, Paul? I have to say, Peter has such sincere kindness. And that's really the core. You know, you're talking about what he does in the meetings. But, you know, I get to see him every day when he looks out the front porch and he sees somebody in the park who's struggling and he decides to check in and make sure they're okay. Or he sees a police officer responding to a call that needs assistance because there's a 6-year-old young man strapped into the back of a car that's been abandoned basically by his father. I mean, the things that you don't see are really what inspires me about Peter, and the kindness that drives him to do those things.
And the kindness of people on all sides. Like, exactly. Some people want to rescue the kid or the person.
Exactly.
They either get so consumed with victims of crime that they demonize the people who commit the crimes, or they're so concerned legitimately with with people who've been screwed by society and sometimes act out and need help, that they might demonize cops or people complain about the crime. And Peter has managed through all these years to advocate for everybody.
Yeah, exactly.
And try to find solutions. Well,
we're trying our best, and it's really hard. And I know that police get a bad rap, but I think that the department that we have in this city should be judged on its own merits and not compared to departments in other cities, because I've seen what these women and men do 24 hours a day, and I couldn't do it. Yeah. And so
well, I always thought that was the big mistake of the 60s was the demonization of police officers.
Yeah.
Like, it was really important about police misconduct, just like it's really important to talk about journalistic misconduct. And it's really important in every field to talk about misconduct. But by calling cops pigs, in my opinion, when they're doing a really tough job that most people wouldn't want to do.
No,
I thought it was really classist and bigoted. And that I still believe today, like, the Independent, we crusade against isolate incidents that we think are really bad police misconduct, including the arrest of one of our photographers. But that doesn't mean that most cops are that way. It doesn't mean those same cops aren't doing great work in other days, and that I think it gets us further from solving problems by demonizing either side of law enforcement, right. You know, the arrestees or the arresters.
I'm a gadfly. I'm out at all hours of the day and night, and I've just seen so much stuff going on, and it's the people who are shooting people are weird doing that, not them. And we need to work together.
We do. And we also have to remind people that are listening to Dateline New Haven on WNHH Radio, your home for community radio at 103.5 FM and live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. Thanks to the people sending in comments and listening at home or watching us on Facebook Live. And we've been talking to Mary Lou Oleski and Peter Webster, a power couple in the sense of behind the scenes making a difference as opposed to pushing people around or getting their name out every day. They're leaving after 11 great years in New Haven, Mary Lou as the head of the International Festival of Ideas, and Peter as an activist throughout town on policing issues, community development issues, and loving the arts as well, which I guess is your profession, right? Don't you do opera?
Yeah, I do most of it outside of New Haven, though. Like this fall, I'm going to direct a play. In Houston, I'm going to be working with Utah Opera, and I'm designing a gala for someone. So I'll have a busy fall.
How did you guys meet?
We met through the theater, basically.
When and where?
Houston, Texas.
Well, so who's going to tell the story, me or you?
Okay, well, I'll do it more spicy.
I want you both to. Okay. Let's hear Mary's loose first and then Peter's spicier version.
All right, okay.
So I was the general manager at the Alley Theater in Houston, and Peter was hired, and this was in the 80s, late 80s? No, early 90s. And Peter was hired to join the company and to start what was then a kind of groundbreaking idea, which was that a theater would have an outreach department and would engage with community that wasn't really happening in the arts. And Peter grew up in Mexico City. His first language is Spanish.
Absolutamente.
His family lived in New Haven, in Houston, so it was a good match, except for one problem. He was one of the most arrogant, insufferable people I had ever met.
God, I can't imagine that.
Oh, yeah,
no. Oh, it was unbelievable.
Okay, time has mellowed you. Okay.
It was unbelievable.
Because I think of the opposite words from Peter.
Well, that's because...
So people can change. Wow.
That's because of Mary Lou, actually.
Very cool.
I was a nasty, it was that Y chromosome thing, and I...
Sure, my wife did that to me, but I never got to your place. I haven't completely gotten rid of it. Anyway, so tell me about the day you met and what it was like.
So we met by phone, mostly, when I was dealing with his contract, he was just awful. He was just awful to deal with, even on the phone. And when he arrived,
this is the guy who runs
the
community management teams in like the heroic Gandhian way.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And he arrived with this kind of sense of grandeur and
grandeur
and superiority that was like just had me rolling my
eyes.
How old
were you guys at the time?
We've been married for 25 years.
We've known each other for 26.
So it was 26 years ago. Okay.
Yeah, so century. He was in his early 40s. I was in my early 30s. But, right?
I don't know.
I don't know. Anyway,
so you didn't mean it a math contest. Okay.
No. And then we kind of bought He didn't think we fought, but I thought we fought for about a year.
What were you fighting about?
I just, like,
everything.
Give me one example.
He would come up with these ideas, and he would show up in my office as if he could command my attention at any point in time he wanted.
Give me one idea, whether he was, like, pushing you.
He was going to do a pastorella, a passion play. It was the passion play.
It was not a pastorella. No.
He was going to do a passion play in a church, in a barrio. And he had this whole graphic element that he had been thinking up that was completely counter to the brand of the organization, and it had death dies, love wins, or something, and a skull. And it was just like... And he shows up in my office.
I would have been the first person attending that, by the way.
Embrace this idea. And
did he expect to stop everything you're doing and doing exactly what he wanted to write then? Which people who have great ideas, I don't have good ideas, but when you have an idea, you think that's how it works.
So he got expelled from my office.
Whoa. So Peter, how'd you feel about being expelled
It was actually Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, right.
That's right. Okay.
But he did the church thing.
I did. I proposed doing Romeo and Juliet in English and Spanish using a mix of professional and kids. And
sounds like an Arts and Ideas of production.
And I wanted to do it in city parks, so I got an ally on the Houston Parks and Recreation Department, and we did it, and we went to 10 city parks, including one that had a horrendous riot where I had to direct differently in each one. I had police cars roaring into one. I had people on horseback coming into another one.
Wow.
But I tried to pitch this to Mary Lou, and I must say, I went to her office, and she had a phone in one ear, a phone in the other ear.
Wow.
She was looking at a computer screen. Now this is 1990.
Back in the day, phones that had cords?
Yes. Yeah, so yeah, and this is and these were like computers that are not as powerful as a smartphone is. She was typing on her computer, talking to two different people, and then I came in and I started to talk, and she said to one person on the phone, "I'm putting you on hold," and then she said to the other person, "I'm putting you on the hold," and then she turned to me and said, "I know you have something to say. Can you say it in 10 words or less and then leave my office?" I won't say what she actually said because I'm busy. And I looked at her and I thought, I love this woman. And I did it in 10.
She's looking at you saying, I want this guy out of my office.
And I did it in 10 seconds and I got out.
What were
and
the 10
she
words?
Saw
wait,
that
wait,
I was...
What were the 10 words? What were the 10 words?
It was...
I don't remember.
It was, Romeo
Great
and Juliet
show,
in English and Spanish, engaging the community, 10 different places around. And I went to places in Houston that people didn't go to.
So then you left?
I left and I got the thing and I did the adaptation into.
So did you? When he left, what did you think?
I'm glad he's gone.
I was glad he was gone.
but did you do his program?
No, I mean, fundamentally, we're together because we both, you said, that sounds like an Arts and Ideas program. I mean, we were both passionate about this.
So you listened
work.
To him, you said, I'm glad he's gone, but what a good idea, and then you actually staged the program.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what point did you turn like, hey, I actually don't hate this guy, I like this guy?
We went to a dance.
Yeah.
We went to one of the...
was it a date or you happened to...
No. Our first date was watching the seals at the Houston Zoo.
But that was after
that. Was after
so
that.
What was the dance?
So we were working with an organization in Houston. In fact, this is the same organization he's going to go back and collaborate with, Mecca. And it was a barrio-based collective about arts
multi-ethnic.
And And they had a gala, and there was salsa music, and we were like the grown-ups in the room, and we were expected to dance. So we danced, and we fell in love.
My wife.
So was it at that dance?
Yeah.
So when you were dancing, did you feel a change?
Yeah.
I mean, classically, obviously, you had passion about this person. It's just that the first was negative passion.
Right.
He had positive passion. But was it during that salsa dance?
Yes. It was a merengue, actually, which is a really fast dance.
So how art
dance.
Can bring people together.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
My wife is also... a fabulous dancer, and she muy caliente, and really wonderful. And so, you know, there were these, actually, Mary Lou, it wasn't a gala. It was a rehearsal. It was a rehearsal dance for Romeo and Juliet. So we had the room filled
with the fact-checking you both do to each other.
With people from El Salvador and Guatemala and Panama and Mexico and I mean, just every kind of person. And they put on the record. Merengue is really, it's like, and they thought, oh, the old white people are going to like that. And then they went, oh, and we did good.
So I have to say something about you in the context of this conversation. You know, people don't realize that I think you were the first person that ever called Peter an activist. He was shocked when he read that about himself.
Yep.
Because up until we came to New Haven, Peter was making these groundbreaking, site-specific, multinational, even in California, he worked with the Old Globe Theater and did a bilingual Romeo and Juliet in Tijuana and in San Diego. And on top of that, he was a world-renowned and continues to be an important drama coach for opera singers, some of the most important opera singers in the world right now, Joyce DiDonato, Eric Owens, were his students. And when we came to New Haven, Peter never promoted himself in that way.
It's the humblest guy just about I know.
Once. And he basically took that passion and that artistry and committed it to family and community in a way that was so and is so profoundly generous that all of my unbelievable misrepresentation of him as an arrogant, insufferable person was overcome. And I think, you know, Peter doesn't get thanked enough for putting his own artistry aside and actually turn that energy into the passion of an activist. And, you know, that's kind of what I said when we first started talking. New Haven taught us how to be citizens
yes.
in a way that we hadn't known.
Yeah. And it's when I was an actor, I didn't like it because in the first place, you have to do the same. Can I say damn?
Yes.
Okay. You have to do the same damn thing 8 to 10 times a week. And when I was on Broadway and I had to do that for like a year and a half, I just thought, oh, this is really boring. I might as well, you know, what? This isn't art. This is craft, yes. But then as a director, you get to go home at night and you get to change hats. And I just, you know, being in New Haven, you get to do that. You get to put elements together.
Yeah.
And my joy in looking at my daughter is to see her becoming independent, self-sufficient, self-confident, and moving on ahead with her wonderful, inventive life. And the people that I have come in contact with, there's a wonderful artist called Amon Ra. I met him. He had all his possessions on his back and nowhere to stay, nowhere to live. But this man was making drawings that like open up your heart and your eyes, and he kept working at it. So how can you not celebrate and work with someone like that?
And how could you not celebrate the love, the beautiful love you guys have for each other? I'll tell you, I'm a sucker for love and a love story, and I'm still just melting it. I just watched you guys do in 10 minutes talking about how you met each other. And that love story is about Peter Webster and Mary Lou Olesky, their love for New Haven, but even more for each other and for art here on WNHH Radio's Dateline New Haven or 103.5 FM Lodge, streamed at newhavenevent.org. We just got a few minutes left, and I want to make sure to check in on what you're doing next. So Mary Lou, you're going to be running something called the Hopkins Center at Dartmouth College. What is that?
So the Hopkins Center at Dartmouth is was built in 1962. It's a huge performing arts center. It was built by the same architect that made Lincoln Center. So same period, same arches
looks
that
like
you
Lincoln
look like
Center.
That you have at the Met. It's a small version of it. We don't have the Chagalls, but we do have Ellsworth Kelly's installed. It's an academic center. It's where the theater and music department lives, and it's also a performance space and a community space. But the thing about the work that I'm going to be doing is not as much about revitalizing and energizing the Hopkins Center as it is to kind of redefine the work that Dartmouth does as a college with arts and creativity at the center. The leadership has really embraced this notion that it's had a rich history in arts and culture, but realizes that You know, you can put out a lot of financiers and computer science majors, but when you embrace creativity through arts and humanities, you make better people. And that's what the future of Dartmouth is going to be about. And I'm feeling very fortunate to be a person who's been asked to help drive that for the president and the provost.
Well, if you do one-tenth of what you did here in New Haven, it's going to happen up in Dartmouth, too. And Peter, you're following, as usual, you're following your wife. That's a little reversal of the traditional 1950s style of how people moved when the man gets the job.
Well, I used to direct, and there was one year when I was home, like maybe less than a month. And when Mary Lou got the gig at the International Festival of Arts and Ideas, I said, you know, well, look, you've put up with me directing in Mexico and here and there and everywhere, and it's your turn. And I don't feel less a man because I'm able to walk the dog or take care of matters like that. I'm still a guy. And I've still got creative stuff to do, but I think that partnership and dynamic equality in a relationship is absolutely vital. And this is a woman who has sparked my interest, my curiosity for 26 years. And I think that I'm really proud of her for what she's accomplished here. But I've seen her do this in cities all across the country, and I'm looking forward to seeing what she comes up with next. And I've got some projects in the works.
So. I'm sure you do, yeah. Peter. Well, thanks so much for your being so open, telling us thanks for everything done in New Haven. I'm going to miss bumping into you guys in the street because I'm happy and inspired every time I do. But I'm not sad that you're leaving New Haven, Mary Lou Olesky and Peter Webster. Instead, I'm grateful for all that you brought to the city and how your contributions are going to remain here long after you're gone. So we thank you for all the great things you've done 11 years in New Haven, and wish you even more success as you move to New Hampshire and greater pastures.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So thank you for joining us today in Dateline New Haven. Thanks to our guests, Mary Lou Olesky and Peter Webster, two of the great people we'll ever meet. A special thanks to Yale New Haven Hospital for providing support for today's program. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Feel to Be Free, from the group CD, A Plea for Peace. Now we know what it's like to be free. We just got to remember to book our flight. Book your flight with us all day and all night long here at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.